today on the Warren Weeks Show podcast.
It was this kind of one moment. It was one evening where I just said, I am about to lose everything. Like, if I continue down this path, I will lose my job. I will lose my family. Like, I'm headed to disaster. And so I didn't have that quintessential rock bottom story. But I have no doubt that if I had kept going, I would have. And I think that's important to say, is that you don't have to have a rock bottom to know that it's not serving you. You know, you don't have to say, I think I've got a problem with alcohol, to be concerned about whether it's benefiting you. And I know now, 3 years sober, that for me, living with anxiety and OCD, it did not serve me. It effectively numbed my anxiety and OCD. And that was, you know, essentially I was self-medicating, but it always made it worse.
My guest today is a communications pro from Nova Scotia, Canada. We talked about the state of the communications profession, her experience running her own business, and the national conversation she started a few years back about drinking culture and all those wine mom memes you see out there. This is someone I've been following on Twitter for many years, and I was really thankful to get the chance to chat with her over Zoom recently. This is my conversation with Allison Garber. Thanks so much for doing this.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited.
Allison, Allie, what should I call you for today?
Well, I'd respond to both. Most people call me Allie.
Okay. I feel like I know you. You're one of these Twitter people, right? That I've been following you for years and watching your family and your work and the stuff you've been doing in the media. And I feel like we're friends, but this is the first time we've ever actually, I think, spoken in person on Zoom.
It is. You were actually one of the first people I followed, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, one of the OGs. But I'm such a fan of your work, and you know, we're in the same industry, and your media training and media tips are just, you have a fantastic account and share really incredible information. So I've always loved connecting with you, but this is the first time we've actually been, I was going to say face to face.
As face to face as you can be. At this point in time. Well, that's very nice of you to say. If anyone, I'm glad this is audio only, cause I'm sitting here fidgeting. It makes me uncomfortable, but, thank you very much for that. There's a ton to talk about with you, and most of it I think is in your Twitter bio. I think you kind of encapsulate who you are and what you do in there. And so I'd like to hit on each of those topics, if we can. And I'm sure we probably have a ton of people in common. You know, I've done work out east and in the communications world. So if it's okay, I'd like to start out with the whole communications realm. You know, you've been on your own for over 10 years, and even that is a subset. That's a very interesting thing to do, and running your own communications business. We could talk for probably 4 hours about this, but what's your take on the state of corporate communications in Canada today from where you sit?
That's a big question. Oh, it's remarkable how our industry has changed. Well, let me back that up. It's remarkable how much our industry has needed to change over the last decade. And it's remarkable to watch how some of the largest organizations have remained stagnant. Meaning, I know when I first started out in communications, the advice that we were given in PR school was, you know, a lot of the senior leadership won't always take into account what communications, you know, what council communication gives them. I think, sadly, this is still true in large part today. And you're seeing that in some of the actions of some of the bigger companies. It's interesting, you know, especially with social media and the evolution of digital media platforms, there really is no picking and choosing who you speak with. And I'd be interested to kind of hear what your thoughts are on this, because I had a recent incident with a client where, you know, was questioning not the credibility of the platform, but, you know, it's a smaller outlet, you know, is this somebody that we typically want to talk to? And, you know, there's potential contentious things about the topic we're discussing. And My take, Warren, is that really, if you are proud and believe in the products and the services and the work that you're doing, then you should be able to confidently speak to that, no matter who is reaching out. I mean, no, not the rebel. I don't know if you have differing views, but that's kind of a hard no for me. But if I just think that in this day and age, we have, there's so many competing channels for information, and it's really hard to predict what story or publication or piece will go off and go viral, or at least kind of go across the internet and, cause, an impact, either negative or positive, for your organization.
Hmm. I hear your comments about the executives. Just before we got on this call, I had a pitch meeting with an organization who's looking to do media training, and the impetus, like the reason she ended up calling me was these little, arguments or just butting heads with executives where they would have, and I won't say what sector they're in, but every sector has their own issues, but they would have these things that would come up, and there's like this pressure around the issue. And by simply doing an interview properly and addressing it, the pressure goes away, and then the story goes away and you're allowed to, move on and then do something else. But time and time again, they would have these situations where something would pop up. It's kind of a contentious thing. They get a call from a local journalist, and then the people who make the decisions, they don't really, communications is telling them what they should be doing, but they're not really, they play the hierarchy card. Like, thanks a lot, I'm the CEO, yeah, or I'm the director or whatever. Yeah, thank you very much. And at the end of the day, I really think it's about fear. I think it's, and I get it. If I am a leader of an organization and I don't really know what I don't know about media interviews, I don't, I'd be scared too. Like, the risk reward ratio for someone to do a media interview, first of all, if you do nothing, you stick your head in the sand, you sit in your office. Yes, maybe the organization takes a hit, and which is not great, but I think a lot of people are looking at this from a very self-preservation mode. There's cancel culture, and one wrong word and your career could be over. And so I understand that, but at the same time, I don't respect it at all. I really believe that this stuff, it's not rocket science. It's not brain surgery. You can go through a one-day intensive experience or session and figure out how to do this stuff. And so, you talked about picking and choosing media outlets. And of course, I think if I like the Rebel, you'd probably know that you wouldn't be following me on Twitter. I have to say,
I guess.
The only organization that I have counseled clients to not speak with, and it's actually changed over the last couple of years, is Marketplace or shows like that, right? So you'll have these, and almost call them not journalism. It's kind of, because the National doesn't play the same clip in slow motion 8 times with music over it. You know what I mean? And so I think that it's kind of like half 60 Minutes, half TMZ, half, Real Housewives kind of show. And so...
Really good descriptor.
Well, and I've had some organizations who, and these are well-meaning folks. Someone would come to them and say, from Marketplace, and say, look, we're working on a story. There's at least 2 clients that I've had in the past, like, couple of years. We're working on the story. It's pretty confrontational, pretty contentious. We want to speak to you. But they don't tell you everything that they know. We say, okay, well, what's the issue? Well, you'll find out.
That's not
really what we want to get into. And so... what I've told people is Marketplace, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this too. Marketplace to me of 2021 is not the Marketplace of 30 years ago. Like, the audience numbers are so much smaller. And so my counsel to those organizations now, it's like, I'm supposed to be interviewing you. Here I am taking up all the oxygen. What I tell those people now is, like, let's see what happens on the show. And then once you see all of everything laid out before you, then you can respond on social media and say, you might have seen that show last night, and we'd like to clear up a few things. And what's happened in both cases is the show came out and nothing happened. Like, nothing. There was maybe 3 tweets by someone, and then it just kind of went away. And so that to me is, I agree, anything other than, like, and I would consider that gotcha journalism. I think anything other than that, and you should be able to.
I think you're right. I think that is the exception to kind of the, I won't say rule, but totally different. You know, yeah, that approach is very much, in my opinion, getcha journalism.
So how did you get into this world in the first place, the corporate communications, public relations, media relations? When did you know that this was where you wanted to make your career?
My dad worked in public relations. So his whole career kind of at a couple different places, was in public relations and communications. And, you know, I think we like to joke that I, you know, try to ignore the call to the family business. But I think I learned a lot from him, and I really enjoyed watching what he did, particularly within the realm of government relations. That always interested me, you know, how to effectively communicate the work of government, although I wouldn't have been able to articulate it as well back then. But I remember when I was 9 or 10, there was a job ad in the paper for my dad's agency. He worked at an ad agency, communications agency back then. And without him knowing, I, you know, on loose leaf with, you know, a marker applied as best as one does when they're 10 years old, sent in a picture of myself. I was looking for a gig. Anyways, we held on to that, thankfully. But I think, you know, yeah, it started with my dad, but also, look, math is not my forte. I'm never going to work at NASA, but I do feel like I've got a really good strength in terms of making things make sense for people. So taking really complicated information and trying to translate that into plain language. I also feel like I've got a good filter of right and wrong, you know, and really trying to assess a situation and trusting my advice for a client in terms of this is how we should respond. And that, you know, that comes in handy with media relations. And I think that there's, you know, where that does maybe sometimes get me into trouble is that my go-to will always be to be transparent and accountable and forthcoming, you know. And yes, there are times where, you know, you do need to be a bit more, not hide information, but protective about how things are said or positioned. But I feel like I could list off so many examples of, you know, we talk about cancel culture of, you know, when people are truly accountable and apologize right, really most people are good and most people can see that for what it's worth, right? It's it's a very inarticulate response to that question, but I think I love communications. I love telling stories, and by that is, you know, doing a lot of the writing I do. And one of my favorite aspects of public relations is writing editorials. Like, I wish I could just have a business for that. I'm sure some people do. But I really love being able to take an organization's vision and the work they do and be able to try to package that into a story that's really relatable to, you know, the everyday person who's sitting at I guess we don't read print newspapers, but who's sitting with their tablet reading, you know, the Globe or our local media.
One of the words you used in that description, and it wasn't inarticulate at all. I thought it was great.
Used a lot of them.
The one that really jumped out at me was love. I love when I do such and such. And there's a lot of people in this business, and you get to know a lot of them in person. You get to know a lot of them online. And, you know, I think at this point, each of us probably knows hundreds of people in this profession that I feel really fortunate to be a part of. But there are people who use these skills for nefarious purposes. And I'm thinking, like, I can't help but think of, like, the guy at Facebook right now, the public relations guy at Facebook, who is with everything that's going on there, you know, attacking the media and just flipping the script and trying to make themselves out as victims. And not to just single out Facebook, because they're such an easy target these days, but and you mentioned government relations too. Like, I made a decision like 5 or 6 years ago to not actually do media training with politicians anymore, just because I just, you know, I watch them do these interviews on TV and I want to throw my remote control through the TV screen, because it's like taking it just an extra step too far. And, you know, people will have different opinions on that. And that,
I know what you mean. I know what you mean. Yeah. It's that old, you know, key message island where it's just like, it becomes just repetitive key messages instilled and there's no authenticity to it at all. Yeah.
I call it like 1992 media relations, right? And just to pick a year from the past, the stuff that worked back then, for whatever reason, I mean, maybe social media is a big part of it, doesn't work today. Like, if you did the same, like, well, I can't speak about that thing you asked me about, but what I can tell you is this whole other thing over here. Like, it just doesn't work anymore. So
yeah, the segue.
So I want to get back to that word love. So what does a perfect day look like for you? Or can you think of a client engagement or, and you know, without, you know, divulging, you know, any client names or anything like that, but can you think of a project where you left it and your heart and your brain were full? You're smiling.
Yeah, I can think of a number. I think that's the beauty in having your own consultancy. And I used to work at an agency and I loved it. I loved the people there. I learned so much because you got to work, you know, on a whole, you know, you got to touch on a whole bunch of different industries and types of communications. But marketing wasn't my thing. Like, it's not my thing. I'm not good at it. It's not how my brain works. And so when I went on my own, I was able to, you know, I don't know whether it was, I don't know how it happened, but I feel just really lucky that I started and have maintained to this day, fantastic working relationships with really good clients. And I think, you know, when you do good work with those clients, then, you know, word of mouth and you kind of are contacted by like-minded clients. And so I've had the real honor of working on projects that matter. A lot of them are pertaining to mental health strategies, workplace safety strategies, working on plans, you know, for one of those for Nova Scotia Community College, like just, I guess organizations I really believe in, and I at the risk of sounding really Pollyanna, I just feel, you know, it's nice when you can go to work and feel as though you're actually kind of, you know, you're contributing to something. You're using your skill set towards, you know, bettering the place you live in. And it's taken a while to get to that place. And certainly I'm sure, well, I don't want to speak for you, but I certainly have taken on projects where I'm like, never again. This is horrible. This doesn't feel good. You know, it's not worth the invoice. So I've learned over the years to not do that, you know, and I don't know, for somehow it's worked out.
What made you start your own business? That's a big leap. And it's a very scary thing to go from working in an agency or working in a company and having that check every 2 weeks. There's a certain feeling. I think it's an illusion of safety, but there's a certain safety in that. What was it? Was it an event or an epiphany or some life situation that made you take that leap?
It was all of the above. So I'd been working in agency, and before that, I had done a stint in government working as a policy advisor for a minister. But I was on maternity leave after having my first child. And I remember thinking, going on maternity leave, like, I'll get back to work early. And, you know, it's just kind of this, I don't know. I think I was really feeding into the, you know, I want to have it all sort of mentality. And I didn't appreciate, obviously, what comes with being a parent and how your life changed. And for me, I know it's not like this for everybody, but I really loved that time with my son. And I realized that the work-life balance of agency for me wasn't going to work. I was never good at setting boundaries in workplaces like that. I would go in at 7 a.m. I'd go home for dinner and then I'd be working until 11 at night. I found it really, and I think that's also the pace of marketing. Like, there's just different pressures of like, this print ad's due then, and creative brief needs to go here. And it was a lot. So I made the I talked actually to a mentor of mine, Gerald Wassine is his name, and he worked at Nova Scotia Power at the time, and he's now with Amira Incorporated. Anyways, he was fantastic. He said, you know what, you are perfectly capable of going out on your own and doing your own thing. He's like, what I'll tell you is that before you make the decision, line up three people that you believe will get you, you know, through the first few months. And then you ask those three people to send introductions to three of their people. And so I did that. And I was incredibly lucky too, Warren, because the agency that I was leaving, I sat down with the president at the time and I said, here's where I am. I really want to focus on public relations. I think it's going to provide a better balance for me. Are you okay with this? He was. And not only that, they actually, I'm still working with that agency. They've evolved and have a different name, but I basically provide their public relations support and they've kind of become fully marketing based. So I was lucky in that regard, but it turned out really well too. My son, when he was four, was diagnosed with autism. And prior to that, you know, we weren't sure what was going on. You know, we were first time parents. He was hitting all of his milestones. You know, I was carefully, perhaps some would say obsessively, reading the, you know, the baby books of like what he should be doing at what times. But, you know, his communication was different and his sensory challenges were a lot different. So having the ability to organize my schedule around appointments for him has been an incredible asset for our family. My husband also, I should say, works in government. I have the great privilege of being able to depend on his healthcare benefits, for example, because that aspect of self-employment is really hard as well. You don't have that cushion. So kind of things just lined up and I have no doubt I made the right decision for sure, but it is risky. Like it's a risk.
What would your advice be to, young communicators today or I guess folks who might be, and I weirdly assume that everybody where you want to get to is you want to have your own business. And I realize, you know, intellectually, I know that's not the case, but to me it's been just the freedom. Like, you know, you work like a dog and there is that low humming anxiety that's always there when you're an owner. But to me, it's, I would really recommend it to anybody who thinks that they could. What would your advice be, you know, having been in it for like 11 and a half years now, what would be your advice to someone who wanted to make that jump, but didn't think they had it in them, or there's that fear barrier? If you had a couple, pieces of advice for them or wisdom, what would it be?
My first advice would be for, and you know, follow it if you want, ignore it if you'd rather, but would be to spend some time working for other people. And my recommendation would actually be for an agency type environment where you get to really sample different aspects of communication. So, you know, the nonprofit side, the very heavily corporate side, government relations, where you really get a sense of kind of the different types of communications. And you also get that mentorship in that environment that you don't really necessarily get on your own. So I would say my advice would be spend some time out there in the world, get some of those people skills and skills that you really can only get while working in a team environment. The second thing I'd say is talk to other consultants who are out there on their own. I keep saying I was really lucky. I'm a very lucky person. But I had the benefit of having a number of good friends, women who were freelance consultants themselves, and they were so open and kind and giving in terms of, here's how you set this up. Here's an accounting program that works really well. What are your rates? Nope, you need to go higher. This is what, you know, and that's really unexpected. And I don't know if everybody does that, but by talking about money, which we're so worried to do sometimes, allowed me the confidence to understand how much I could ask for my hourly rate. And then the last piece of advice is just kind of exactly what Gerald told me back in the day, is reach out and get a sense of, you know, you don't need tons to start because, of course, that builds over time. Get a few key contracts, people that you believe can kind of build on the initial jobs and projects, and people that also know other people that can help, you know, talk about who you are and what you do.
Nice. Now, anyone who does a cursory Google search of your name, the stuff that comes up on page one is, and I found this really interesting to watch because I felt like I Twitter knew you and we had exchanged, you know, tweets a couple times or, you know, like different things over the years. And then there was this flurry of media activity. I think it was around 2 years ago. Is that correct? This was the...
I had a flurry of things. Like I,
a couple flurries. I'm talking about the...
I created some flurries here, Warren, mostly around, there's like hot things I'm known for is like inclusive education because we're not advocates for that with Hugh. And then also kind of my own journey with being an advocate for mental health and most recently addiction. I opened up about my story with addiction. Yeah, this was 2 years ago.
It was the mommy wine thing or the, what they call it, wine to unwind culture. And I had never, it's interesting because you to me were the person that kind of brought this up. I had always seen, you know, you go to these like, I don't know if you've been, no, you probably haven't. There's like these little rustic sort of farmhouse pumpkin patch kind of places you go. And then there's this little shop in there and they have all these signs you can hang around your house or your cottage, you know, hockey this and kids that. And about a third of them are about drinking wine, and it's usually targeted to the mom, right? Like, or the kids are the reason I drink, or all the different little puns. And have always thought those were cute and kind of funny and had never really scratched below the surface of that. And then you had this blitz of media coverage when you went public with your story about that, because you were one of those kind of wine moms. I don't even know where you want to start with this, but like, to me, there's the whole, subculture of that and just the pervasiveness of it, your awareness of it. And I've listened to a couple of other podcasts that you were on when you talked about the fact that, like, I was holding down a job, I'm raising a family, I didn't think I had an issue. When was it that you realized that this might be a problem for you and you decided to take action?
It's the whole wine mom culture, which is like honestly like the term. You talked to my Twitter bio before, and a friend joked that I should put former wine mom in there because there was some article I was in that like said former wine mom, and it was just like, oh God. I mean, the whole thing's cringeworthy, but those memes and the jokes, etc., I've said allowed me my problem to stay hidden in plain sight for many, many years. Like, I thought they were so cute and so relevant, and I, you know, your Facebook memories show up. Like, oh, that's always a fun surprise sometimes when memories pop up. But there was a meme that I'd shared years ago, and it was like, give me the coffee to accept the things I can change and the wine to accept the things I can't. And I was like, oh my God. But, you know, so that really kind of made me feel as though I wasn't alone, right? It wasn't like, I enjoy one glass of wine. Like, it was, you know, images of women with, you know, holding a bottle of wine. And so I kind of felt like, oh, I bet everyone's kind of having more than one. And then it became like, oh, everyone's having more than two. And you know, you could joke about it with people. And I feel as though I almost compulsively joked about it to like get the feedback I needed of like, oh yeah, me too. And yeah, I totally like had too much last night. I was so stressed out to both the kids. And so, you know, it didn't feel like a problem until it was so apparent it was a problem. And for me, really, when I noticed the problem was when my mom was diagnosed when her cancer became terminal, and all of the kind of protocols I had put in place to hide my consumption or make it normal really fell by the wayside. And I remember specifically at one point the summer before I got sober, like I was drinking during the day. Like, we were at a cottage and I would come up to, you know, get something and like pour a glass of wine. I started buying vodka. At one point I think I bought tequila, which is like when but I was still able to sort of hide it from my family. Like, even my husband, who, you know, was really trying to softly be like, I know things are tough, but like, this is, are you okay? And it really fell apart. And so I came to this, it was this kind of one moment. It was one evening where I just said, I am about to lose everything. Like, if I continue down this path, I will lose my job. I will lose my family. Like, I'm headed to disaster. And so I didn't have that quintessential rock bottom story. But I have no doubt that if I had kept going, I would have. And I think that's important to say, is that you don't have to have a rock bottom to know that it's not serving you. You know, you don't have to say, I think I've got a problem with alcohol, to be concerned about whether it's benefiting you. And I know now, 3 years sober, that for me, living with anxiety and OCD, it did not serve me. It effectively numbed my anxiety and OCD. And that was, you know, essentially I was self-medicating, but it always made it worse. It was just this constant chasing that cycle, right? Of it helped the anxiety at night. I was finally able to sleep, you know, but then the next day it would just chase until the next time I could have a drink. So life is a lot different now. It's life is fantastic now.
Thanks for sharing that. I did an interview about a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, with Clint Hill. I don't know if that name rings a bell, but he's the Secret Service agent from the JFK assassination. And not to draw a parallel, but you know, you talk about the numbing effect of alcohol and kind of just making things acceptable or go away. So this guy, obviously, you know about the JFK assassination. He's the guy who climbed up on the car, but anyway, spent basically the next 40 years in his basement just drinking scotch. And luckily he met this woman who was an author, and he'd been approached by many authors over the years and told them, you know, go to hell. For whatever reason, he talked to this woman, and they've written three books together about his days, and his life completely changed. And, you know, not drinking anymore. I think he's almost 90 years old. He's 89 or 90, and like, just like totally with it and super, like, he corrected me, I think, on three little dates or things in our interview, which was amazing. But that's what it kind of puts me in mind of. He was using this traumatic incident. And back then there was no post-traumatic stress disorder. There was deal with it. There was like Clint Eastwood, be tough, figure it out. And I can't help but feel bad for that human being who spent four decades just kind of drinking away the guilt and everything else. When you hear a story like that, like have people reached out? You must get emails and messages from people who are kind of in a similar boat. What does that look like? Like, what are they asking you, or what are they telling you?
I do. And sometimes it can be really, heartbreaking and scary, right? Because some people are reaching out when they're really, really in a troubling place. And so the best I can do, knowing I'm not a professional, is direct them to urgent support and try to stay with them while they follow through and reaching out. But what has been really profound for me is the number of messages, you know, I've received from strangers, but also from women I know who have reached out, and they're like, I am struggling. I think I'm in the same position. It's been really eye-opening. You know, all these people that probably looked at me in the same way, saying, you know, like, oh, they're social drinkers and whatnot, that, you know, they open up and they let you know that, you know, I am struggling with anxiety, or, you know, I've going through a really hard time and I'm finding myself drinking every day. You know, it's a bigger problem than I think our culture has really acknowledged. I know too, you know, in hearing the story you just told, I did a talk for Mental Health Foundation of Nova Scotia recently, on kind of how mental illness and addiction is so intertwined. And it's the reality is people self-medicate with alcohol because it works. It works in that moment. It does stop the compulsive thoughts. For me with OCD, it numbs that anxiety. You know, you talked about kind of the hum of anxiety, it numbs that. And so, you know, over time you just need more and more and you become more dependent on it. It is an effective but deadly tool to support people who are suffering from mental illness. And that needs to be talked more often, the correlation between mental illness and addiction. But yeah, it's been, you know, I have to say it's been really touching though too, Warren, because I received an email from somebody 2 weeks ago saying, I saw your story with the National, and I want to let you know that was the last night I drank, and I've been sober for this amount of time. And it's like, definitely not me taking credit for that, but it was like me I think you relate to people that you can connect with, right? She saw her story in mine. And I think that's the power of storytelling. And I know that from my communications, you know, work. Like, it's storytelling is profound and it's life-changing. And it's kind of, it's that thread that holds us all together.
You wrote yourself a list, like on a piece of paper. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
Yeah.
That was right around that time. Is that correct?
I think it was like, if it's the one I'm talking about, where I think it was like really early in my sobriety, like 3 days, yeah, where I wrote down, here's who I want to be. I want to wake up and enjoy a couple, like really what seemingly mundane things, but they're not. Like, it's, I made a joke with a friend who's in recovery as well. And I was like, you know, it's like when you get sober, you can like smell colors. Like, it's just like all, like your senses are more alert. You're more focused. You have clarity. And it's just like your heart is more full. My God, I'm totally Pollyanna. But like little moments that I have with the kids, like before reading to my daughter, I would kind of be irritable where I was like, okay, go to bed. I want, you know, I need to go have a glass of wine, finish up some work. And now it's like my favorite time of day, you know, where you just, you really, I think when you've been in a darker place, you know, those simple moments of joy that take no effort are just so miraculous. Like, if that makes sense. So yeah, that list, I look back on it and I remember writing it. I remember so vividly because, you know, I was drinking to the point where I had physical side effects from withdrawing from alcohol. And so I journaled a lot and, you know, sleep was kind of evasive for the first few weeks. And I just remember being like, this is who I want to be. Like, this is, these are the kind of simple things I want to enjoy. And so knowing that it's come to fruition is pretty amazing.
What are some of the other things that were on that list just from memory? Like, I want, this is where I want to be, or this is who I want to be.
Yeah, I had like, you know, the coffee one stands out. Like, I want to enjoy a cup of coffee in the morning. And it's just, I don't know. I kind of like want to hug that person because I was so tired of waking up feeling like just dirt and, you know, having a coffee because, you know, I needed something to wake me up. But it was, you know, being able to exercise and feel good doing it. I went to the gym, like, you know, throughout, you know, when I was in active addiction. And like, I remember one time I thought I was like going to get sick. Like, it, so it was just like little things, like just being able to exercise and feel good about it. Reading more. I wanted to do more reading. I grew up as a kid, I would walk to the library with my dad every Sunday and I would bring back this like massive bag of books. And my mom always recalled, I would just lock myself in my room and read. And I stopped doing that. Like, I stopped doing the things that brought me so much joy as a kid. Now I read, you know, like I'm on Goodreads, which I don't know if you are. And it's maybe a little bit of my obsessive tendencies, but like I set a target for how many books to read a year and like read about 40, which I think is pretty good when you have two small kids.
That's great.
But, you know, just like really simple things were on that list of just, because I was almost as though I knew, like, don't set the targets too high. Like, let's set some goals like that you may possibly be able to achieve.
But that list must have seemed at the time probably a little bit impossible.
Yeah. That's it. Because I'd done similar things before, right? And that was always so infuriating, is, you know, looking back at journals and just kind of setting targets for myself. So I just continually failed to reach. It was like always knowing that a better me existed, but just never having the willpower and courage to really do what I needed to do to get to her.
Do you regret in any way making the decision to go public about, because I'm sure there's, you know, as much as there's been positive reaction, there's probably been like, that's kind of out there. Do you regret that at all? Or are you proud that you did it?
Regret's a tough, I mean, I regret getting to the place where this is my story to tell. And that's something I need to work on, right? Because, you know, I know all the psychology will say, you know, need to look at the present and blah, blah, blah. But the reality is that I regret the time I wasted being sick. And I think that's hard to get over, right? It's hard to think about what could have been. Do I regret speaking up publicly? No, I don't, because I had been open about my mental illness. I had started to kind of quietly advocate just in terms of what living with OCD was like and generalized anxiety. And I was about 6 months sober, and I reached out to somebody who had been, still is, a huge support in my recovery. And I said, this feels really dishonest in some way, because I am pretty open about life. And I love and respect people who share their vulnerabilities, because it makes others feel less alone. And that may be very cliche, but it's the truth. I got sober because I read books written by, well, Drink by Ann Dowsett Johnson was just, she's a pioneer in in getting into a space that nobody had talked about before. Here's the former editor of Maclean's magazine, VP at McGill University, saying, I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, I was still working, doing all these things, but I had a problem, and here's my story. If she hadn't had written that book, I wouldn't have got that book the first day I got sober. I went to the library and I took about 5 books on, you know, sobriety, and her book saved me. She was like the lifeboat, right? Bringing me, God, let me stop with the cliches. But long story short, Warren, I feel as though I came to the decision because it just felt like people were still messaging me and like, let's go for drinks. And, you know, cause it was such a big part of my life. Like, it really was. It was weird that I wasn't drinking. And it wasn't so much that I thought like people would be shocked or offended that I wasn't. It just felt like I wasn't being transparent and accountable. Like all the things I talked to my clients about, you know, in terms of communication. I know it didn't mean that I needed to go on the national and tell my story, but that's what ended up happening. And I'm okay with that. And, you know, if it's not regret so much as perhaps a little bit of anxiety around, as my kids get older, how is it going to impact them? And that's going to be their story to tell, right? But I will always advocate for them to live their truth and to live their own lives, and tell them that I had to do the same, because I believe I'm a better mother for being able to advocate and speak out about this. And I think that, you know, if anything, I want them to learn that nobody's inherently bad. You know, people can make poor choices and people can really struggle, but, you know, with love and support and the end of stigma or addressing stigma, people get better. And, you know, mental illness is not something that's just kind of relegated to, you know, the rare few. It's something that impacts all of us. And I also think too, like it's the less shame there is in talking about addiction, particularly with alcohol, the healthier we get and the more information we're getting to women about potentially, you know, the challenges that they may be running into.
It's interesting that the first thing you did was to go out and take all those books out of the library. And I actually saw, like, it was the receipt of all the different books and the titles. That was kind of cool.
I saved this.
Such a communicator thing to do. Let's go research this, right? Read as much as I can about it. Did you, the woman who wrote the one book you referred to, did you ever connect with her or reach out to her?
Warren, did I? Yes. Okay. So this is a story. So Dr. Rob Strang, he's the chief medical officer here in Nova Scotia. So he's leading our COVID response, and he's become like quite a folk hero, which I'm on the board of Autism Nova Scotia with him. So we kind of mock him relentlessly about, you know, all the memes and stuff. But I'm good friends with Rob. And early in my sobriety, I reached out to him and I said, hey, listen, you're someone that I trust, and you're a good friend. I want to share with you kind of what's been happening. And he was so wonderful and kind. And I said, listen, I read this book and it's fantastic. And you're actually in it, because Anne had quoted him about, you know, the alcohol industry and impacts on health, et cetera. He's like, do you want me to introduce you? And I said, oh my gosh, yeah. So he's like, I remember it was such a huge deal. Like, I got an email back from her. I was in Toronto to film a segment for Bell Let's Talk. And I asked Anne if she wanted to meet for breakfast. And so we had breakfast and we both cried. Like, it was just such a, I don't know, a coming together of two really common, you know, or like-minded people. I just talked to Anne yesterday. We do some work together. I took part in her Writing Your Recovery program, which is this brilliant, she's not only a brilliant writer, but she's, you know, she's an editor and she's just a gifted teacher. And so it was, she works with women who are in recovery from various different things and goes through exercises in writing. And so these women, everyday women, share the stories at the end of the workshops. And it's just, it's, I don't know. It's just, there's so, I don't know. It's a really beautiful experience, but yes, I have, you know, that's one of my favorite stories is the fact that, you know, I read this book, it changed my life and I was able to actually thank her in person.
Wow. It just, that I wanted to ask that because it seemed to me, again, from the little that I know about you, it seems like you would want to kind of close that loop and connect with her. It's so cool. And for her, it must've been great to know that something that she'd written had had such a profound impact on somebody. That, like, as an author, that's what you want to do, right?
Yeah. And she, yeah, I mean, we really connect. And of course, I'm not the only one who kind of sings her praises at all. But I think it meant a lot to her that I just, you know, kind of hunted her down in the most non-creepy way possible.
That was actually very, very deftly done. There's a there's a quote, there was another podcast that you had done where there was, and you were relating, you know, different elements of the same kind of story. And one of the quotes that you said that, that I found really interesting, because I think it speaks to a certain kind of self-awareness, was, me from 3 years ago would have hated me on this podcast. Like the way that, like, and you talked about being like the self-righteousness. You're the same person, but the fact that you have that self-awareness, can you talk a little bit about who, what you would have hated about that 3 years ago?
Just like the, I was really defensive about people who didn't drink. Like, and this is part of what that meant. So I, one of my really good friends had stopped drinking when I was still absolutely drinking. And I remember like bugging her about it. And now, of course, I am mortified by that. But, you know, the me today who looks at different marketing gimmicks or, you know, how we have that whole mummy wine culture and criticizing it, I would have been so annoyed with myself. Like 4 years ago, it's just like, okay, like lighten up, like, you know, like it's just, it would have annoyed me. And the reality is I annoy a lot of people and I actually have really tried to thoughtfully be, or be more thoughtful and how I talk about this, because there are many women who drink in moderation and they are absolutely cool having a glass of wine on a Friday night. And they make the jokes without meaning anything behind it. And they're not trying to contribute to a culture where women suffer. And so I can appreciate, understand that, like, sometimes, and especially in Earth, like when I first came out to talk about this, I think a lot of the anger I held, anger at myself, was kind of pushed on resentments to the alcohol industry, if that makes sense, and alcohol marketers. So that was angry. I was pissed off that this happened to me. And part of that is, I think, I'm right in many ways. Like the alcohol industry is accountable for a lot of things. But all is to say is that I really had to be cautious in terms of my messaging and, you know, make sure people knew this was my story. And if you could relate to it, then there's help out there for you, that there, you know, you can get better. There is a better way, et cetera. But for people, my friends who, you know, drink in moderation and enjoy having a girls' night out and, you know, having some wine, I really didn't want them to feel like I was judging them or targeting them. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately I missed the mark on that sometimes.
You talked about the numbing effects of, and that might be just making it kind of like a blunt expression, but kind of helping the problems in the moment. How do you deal with that now? Cause like the problems don't go away.
Yeah, no, they don't. So I have OCD and I think that's a pretty, it's
they're connected,
people,
right?
Use that phrase so much, like, oh, I'm so OCD. Yeah. And it's just like, you know, not to be, well, it pisses me off sometimes, to be honest, because people don't, unless you live with OCD, you truly don't understand how challenging it is. It impacts so much of your day if you're not getting the right help and support, and in many cases, including mine, medication. And so Long story short, alcohol numbed things for me. And so I basically, if I was ever faced with a challenging situation or overwhelmed with compulsive thoughts, instead of doing the work and trying to sit through it and address it or talk to somebody or get on the right medication, I just went for the immediate fix. Once I got sober, it's not like, you know, all of a sudden my mental illnesses like fleeted away. They were very much present because I had no tool, right? I had no coping tool to address it. So I went back to therapy. I addressed my medication. I had to change that and found a really good place. Again, it doesn't mean that it's completely gone. I still very much have those intrusive thoughts and compulsions to see it through. Mm. But running has become my main coping tool. I love it. I think there's a reason too why so many people in sobriety take up running. Like, I've never been good, Warren, at, you know, the deep breathing exercises, you know, where you sit on your floor and, you know, clear your head. It doesn't really work for me. I needed something else. And running is effectively meeting kind of the outcomes that those deep breathing exercises are trying to achieve, where I clear my head, I'm controlling my breathing, I'm getting fresh air, I'm moving my body. It is so therapeutic for me. And I've also been able to meet a community. I'm part of a running club. But what I learned in the spring was that I remember messaging my brother because I'd gotten injured after running a half marathon. And I messaged him. I was like, I think I might have replaced alcohol with running. And he's like, oh, do you think? Like, and I was like, did you guys know? He's like, we knew. But because I was injured, I couldn't run. And all of a sudden we're in lockdown.
Yeah.
And I'm homeschooling my kids and I'm doing my work and I don't have that outlet of like, I'm going for a run, you know, which usually before that would have been, I need a drink. So I had to figure it out. And I think it was actually a really healthy, good thing for me where I had to find other ways to cope, you know, and I had to sit through those tough feelings. But I was equipped to do that because I was sober, you know, and because I had started to do the other things that helped me get there.
So I get to cross off one of my future questions now, but the connect, like, you need to switch one for the other.
Yeah.
I know it's funny. I know,
yes, I did is the answer.
At least two or three other people who had issues with alcohol who became obsessive runners and like just loved it. Were you a runner before, or is this something that you jumped into with this life change?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a funny story. So I'd run a 5K before. I went to the gym. I did like the elliptical and the stair climber. I run a 5K, but I'd never, been like a dedicated runner. By that, I mean like going out more than once a year. But it was, my mom was diagnosed with, the cancer metastasized to her brain in the summer. And I quit drinking October 1st of that year. And around November, like I had started to kind of go to the gym more, exercise more, to kind of channel some of that anxious energy. And a friend of mine who had run the 5K with said, you know what? She's like, we should run another race. And, she was in Cape Breton at the time and she was about to go down on the treadmill in the hotel. And she's like, we should do the half marathon. I was like, that is insane. Like we are not like we have done one 5K. She said, no, let's do it. Let's sign up right now before we change our mind. And I'm thinking, you know what, this might be just what I need to get through the next few months and have something consistent and constant that I can kind of just schedule. A routine is very, very important to me. So I was like, all right, I'll do it. Anyway, she ended up backing out. And here I was training for a half marathon on my own throughout my mom's terminal illness. And I ended up running that half marathon a little over a week after she passed away. And it was a really emotional experience that I'm really grateful for.
Jeez. I'm sorry to hear about your mom. And also sorry to hear your friend bailed on you after basically hooking you up. But it's weird how things work out.
It is, yeah.
So your mom passed away around 3 years ago?
It'll be 3 years this spring. So okay. Yeah, two and a half.
That's indescribably, I call it a club. My mom died in 2012 and there's this club, like you don't really understand it until you're in it. Right. And, I don't know, were you there at the time? Like were with her when she passed away?
Yeah. Mom and I were really, really close. And I, again, in a recent, the keynote I delivered for Mental Health Foundation of Nova Scotia, I talked about mom as she was kind of my safe person, right? Like when I was a kid and really, we didn't know I had OCD, at the time. We learned that in my early 20s, but, we just were close. We were the bestest of friends. And, so in the last year, I would go to her medical appointments, and when she went to palliative care in the hospital, we were finally able to get her into Hospice Halifax, which was relatively new. And that was such a blessing, right? And in such a difficult time, where, you know, she was able to spend her final days like surrounded by all of us and getting exceptional care. And, you know, just being comfortable. So I was with her pretty much nonstop in the final week. And I was with her when she passed. And, you know, I remember 3 days before she died, the doctor said to us, the time for meaningful conversation with your mother has passed, meaning that she would need to be sedated. And it was like, I don't know, I'll always remember that line. And so we went down and said goodbye to our mom, basically. And they basically said she won't be able to communicate after this. We said, I love you and whatnot. But then the next morning, my brother and I had slept over, and I was just, you know, rubbing her head and playing with her hair. And I said, I love you, mom. And like really gurgled, she was like, I love you too, dear. And that was the last, you know, this was after she was sedated. And it was just kind of a testament to like my mom's character, right? It's like, she'll always try to find a way to show up for her kids and her family. But, yeah, I was there when she passed, and you're right. It's no one can really fully understand just how profound that experience is until you're in it. When you see your parent being wheeled out of, you know, how do you put that into words when it's like, where does that energy go? Right. Like, it's just, it's a lot.
And the bluntness of like the doctor's bedside manner there, like it just, they're communicating information, but sometimes they just lose the human bit. And I had similar experience as well. So, you know, I always hesitate to even get into this area, but like you kind of dipped a toe in there. Where does that energy go? Where do you think it goes? Like, what do you think, there's something after this?
I don't know, you know, but I feel like there has to be, because I struggle with that. I really do. Like the whole thing, you know, I remember her final night, the nurse came in and mom was like, she had been clearly in, I can't remember what they call it, like active dying or something. And like, that's a whole other thing, right? A whole other thing. Anyways, the nurse came in and she said, it feels like your mom's trying to hang on. Like maybe you could help her kind of to make her way. And so I said, you know, mom, like, it's okay. We're going to be okay. Like you can relax now. You can let go. Like it's going to be okay. And, we love you. We're going to take care of each other. And it was literally like 5 minutes after that, she left us. Yeah. And so I feel like, yeah, it's like, where does that energy that all of us give out into the world, that can't just go. Like it's somewhere. And I do kind of believe in that, in the signs and things like that. There were so many little things like after she passed, right in the immediate aftermath, that were almost like these messages that she was making her way safely. And I realize how this sounds as I'm saying it, but I mean, what are we if we don't kind of have some belief in that, right? Because the alternative is that there's nothing.
It's pretty bleak.
And it's bleak. And I just, you know, my dad said something too. He's like, your mom's in your kid, you know, and your kid and your kids and your children. And she is like, you know, I see her and my daughter, and I, you know, so it's, yeah, it's the alternative is bleak.
What were some of the signs, if you're okay sharing some of them?
Yeah, well, it's like little things that kind of were humorous. Like I remember being at the cottage, my mom and dad's place, and she would always yell at my dad that he never brought the laundry in off the line. So I put the laundry out that day, and I remember blue laundry basket, put it down. It was totally empty. And I said to Dad, I was like, are you going to get the laundry off? He's like, oh, I'm just watching the game. And I was like, I'll go do it. And I start to take it off. And I look down, there's like a dime in the center of the laundry basket, being mom like, go get your father to anyways. And so there's that. And then on the first day of school, I always worry about, well, both my kids, but particularly my oldest, who's autistic, in terms of how he's going to settle in. You know, we advocate so much in advance. And mom was always my person I'd call the days leading up. I'd call right after the school drop off. And this was the first year that she wasn't going to be there for that. And so we always do pictures on the front steps. And there was this blue jay feather right in the spot where our kids sit every year. And, you know, my husband actually was like, oh my gosh, look at this. So there was those little signs. And also she always said she would come back as a deer, and which is kind of a joke, because the deers would always eat her flowers. But my brother was driving up to the cottage after she passed away, and right in the driveway, this mother deer and three baby deer stopped and were just like staring. And it was, yeah, it was pretty profound. Although when I went up the week after, there was a dead crow right at the front of the stairs. So we had to Google that. But
sometimes a crow is just a crow.
Sometimes a crow is just a crow.
So the dime thing is weird. And again, like, some people are going to be listening to this thinking we're crazy, but
no, for sure.
I found that, you know, you live your life, and again, we're in this profession. What you see is what you get. Truthfulness, transparency, right? I find that, you know, when you start talking to people, everybody has a story like this. Everybody. Or if they don't, they have their sister or their brother or someone like this. Every family has its group of little stories like this. And like the thing with the dimes, I totally get. You know, we had situations where on the first day of school, or it was my children's birthdays, we would be going out somewhere to dinner, like in the car, you know, when you kind of bleep, you hit the lock on your car, and it would just do it by itself. But it would do it on the first day of school. It does it on their birthdays. I remember one time right after my mom had passed away, my two sisters and I had bought a house that hadn't been completed yet, and we took a drive up there, and it was dark, and we had a coffee, and we're just kind of sitting there chatting and, you know, reminiscing, talking about my mom. And then the car like did one of those bleep bleep, and just, and you're looking around at each other like, did that just happen? And then it happened again, and, you know, no one's touching any keys. It's not like it's and so you have these little things. And the other one I'll mention, because you mentioned dimes, and these are universal, right? Like the feathers, the dimes. I had gone out for a drive one Mother's Day, and the first Mother's, like the first everything sucks. Like they all, Mother's Day generally sucks now, but the first everything after they pass away is really difficult. And so I had gone out for a drive, and I came and left the garage. And I came back and opened the car door, and there were four dimes sitting right outside the car door on the ground. And she had four kids, right? I'm just like, and there's no way that, like, where they come from, you know, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
My daughter had a situation a couple of weeks ago where she was, you know, when that moment where you just kind of wake up in the morning, you don't know if you're dreaming or you're quite awake. And she heard this like,
yeah.
And a dime just kind of hit her, the floor in the middle of her room. Like, so these are inexplicable things, but it kind of gives me hope that there's something. I don't know.
There's one moment that I can't believe I forgot to tell you this. One moment where, like, I mean, I don't know how you explain it. So we had her celebration of life, we called it, which she would have like eye rolled to high heaven about. But we had in the chapel by our cottage. This is like a small, beautiful wooden chapel in the woods. And so it was just immediate family, and, you know, just not immediate family, but, you know, not a huge thing. Mom didn't want that way. This bird flew in, and we learned after, it was the first time this had ever happened in kind of the priest's experience. And the bird was like flying around the chapel. Anyways, it got to this song where the dad had picked for mom, and we were like, oh, I don't know if she's gonna like this might be more your thing, dad, like, and they were obviously like really close, really loving, but often like mom would just be like, Peter, like, you don't know me, like, you know. So this hymn started playing, and my nephew Spencer was behind me and had his little program, and the bird just crapped, like right down and splattered on the program. And my brother's like, and that's what mom thinks about that. Like, it's just, but it was just so comical, right? And so her personality, like, you know, so I don't know how you explain that, you know,
that's kind of funny.
Poor Spencer, but anyways, it, he was fine. Just got on the program.
It's supposed to be good luck. So I don't know.
Yeah. That's what we told him.
I'm looking at the list of all the hashtags in your Twitter bio. I think we've hit most of them. There's a quote on there that I'd like to get, yeah, and people put those things up there, but I'd like to get your take on it. It's the Dolly Parton quote, find out who you are and do it on purpose. What does that mean to you?
I think it's, it says, well, I mean, who doesn't love Dolly Parton?
She's great.
Like, it's just an icon. But it's really kind of being on unapologetically yourself. And, you know, we talked earlier about my choice to talk publicly about my experiences with mental illness and addiction. And, you know, I did that on purpose. I did that thoughtfully. It's part of who I am. And I'm going to own it. Like, I'm going to be authentic about it. It's a part of who I am. And I think that in this age where we often kind of only present one aspect of ourselves, you know, on social media and, you know, in other ways as well, we're kind of contributing to this perception that you have to kind of always like be achieving this peak form of happiness or you're failing, you know? And I think that the more that we tell these real and authentic stories, sort of what Ann Dowsett Johnson's trying to do with her Writing Your Recovery workshop, it just, we feel closer and more connected, I think, as a community. And by community, I mean like the world, right? Like, there's so much anger and animosity and, pain. And I think it's because we are trying to kind of present this unrealistic aspect of ourselves out into the world. So I guess for me, it's like, I've found out who I am. I'm still learning. And I'm being purposeful about it.
You mentioned having read like 40 or so books per year or kind of striving for that. Any that jump out? I'm always looking for recommendations for people for great books, great podcasts, anything that was really intriguing or eye-opening for you. Anything jump to mind?
Well, Drink, obviously, by Ann Dowsett Johnson was one of the greatest. Educated. Have you read Educated? Mm. So good. You need to read Educated. Well,
I think my girlfriend has the book, told me to read it, and I just put it on in a pile somewhere. Is it like a chair in a field or something? Is that what?
Yes. Yes. You need to.
What's it about? What's the gist of that?
It's a memoir about a woman's experience growing up in pretty extreme poverty, and, you know, finding her way to academia. And I'm making it sound so boring, but like, it's such powerful, you know, characters and storytelling, and like, her writing is just brilliant, and you become so attached to these characters, and like, it's just jaw dropping her experiences growing up with this family and the pain that is caused. And anyways, it's brilliant. I've been reading a lot too, just like of running books. So Born to Run is a great one. Rich Roll's book, Finding Ultra, was great. And it's not just for runners. That was a good one. I went through a really deep Joan Didion phase, and Mary Carr's Lit. So good. Hmm. Yeah. And The Liars Club.
Okay. We'll have to start a podcast book club.
Right.
And are you a podcast person? Do you listen to them or no?
I do.
And what are some of your faves?
You don't want me to bore you with the running ones, do you?
Why not? There could be some runners out there listening.
It's like Running with Ally is one, and not me. It's not my podcast. It's ALI. Pop Chat. Have you heard about a CBC podcast? No. And then Party Lines, which is another CBC podcast. Yours, obviously, Warren.
Oh, jeez.
Avi. Rich Roll's podcast.
He's the guy out in California, right? The long hair.
Yeah, he chooses some really great guests and kind of across like a you know, different kind of perspectives and whatnot that I really find interesting. Like he explores, you know, mental illness and, you know, confidence, et cetera. Brene Brown has one too that I really like that I listen to from time to time.
How do you think, I hesitate to even ask, but how do you think your provincial government has done handling the pandemic, understanding that no one has gotten out unscathed and some provinces have done better than others? How do you think your end of the country has kind of dealt with this year and a half of just craziness?
I think we've done really well. I have to say, you know, it's not to say there hasn't been some blips along the way, but overall, we've had some pretty aggressive policy in terms of, you know, shutting down things quick when our numbers, you know, prior to kind of the higher vaccination rates that we have now, we were pretty quick to go into stronger restrictions. I have to say it's been interesting watching Dr. Strang, who, you know, I am biased, he is a friend, but he's been able to work with three different premiers now. So we had Premier Stephen McNeil, who retired, and Ian Rankin became leader of the Liberal Party and then automatically premier because the party was still in power. And then Premier Tim Houston most recently. And so he's kind of been the constant and consistent voice. And he's it's interesting if you had known Rob prior, not to say that we wouldn't have expected him to do an incredible job, but just the way that he has been able, like he's kind of a media trainer's dream in that he genuinely is just, you know, he puts people at ease and he's able to clarify really complex things. He's a voice of reason. And so I think that the majority of Nova Scotians, there's, you know, definitely a vocal minority who we have in every pocket of the country, I think, against vaccines and mask mandates. But the majority of Nova Scotians see him as a very, very trusted figure and, you know, have the confidence in his ability to see us through.
Anything else you want to touch on before, you know, the typical media question, anything we haven't discussed or that you want to chat about before we let you go?
Loaded question, Warren. I feel like we've covered a vast range of topics. I've enjoyed this conversation a
lot. Likewise. Thank you so much, Allie, for doing this, for making the time. All the best to you and your family.
Thanks so much, Warren. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much to Allison for taking the time to speak with me. And as always, thanks to you for taking the time to listen. If you haven't had a chance to do so yet, please rate, review, or recommend the show. Helps other people find this content. Thank you once again, and we'll see you next time.